Welcome. Thank you so much for coming. I'm here representing the Office of Sustainability. My name is Lilith Wyatt, and I'm the administrator for the Sustainability Projects Fund.
Hi, I'm Joan Butterworth, and I'm the Leadership Training Facilitator from the Leadership Training Program and Student Services First Year Office. Welcome.
So we're really excited to have the chance to bring you guys together today. One for the chance to hear Gerald Butts speak, and two to actually then get the chance to focus on action towards sustainability at McGill within our context and what that could look like. So we'll be talking a bit more about that format later. But keep your ideas in mind because you will be actively participating.
Great. Excited, and I just wanted to speak a little bit because we're excited about working together, the Office of Sustainability and Leadership Training Program, because we do, for my part, in the Leadership Training Program, we have a lot of partnerships that we rely on for our programs. And you kind of go, well, because we have a lot of leadership at McGill, with leadership, there are, of course, like a lot of different definitions that people have, and leadership means different things to different people. In the leadership training program, we're kind of trying to work on broadening the definitions of leadership for everybody. We're looking at the current trends in research and theory of leadership, such as the social change model of leadership, which has certain assumptions about leadership. Some of those assumptions being that it's a collaborative process, it's accessible and inclusive to all. It's a process, not necessarily a position. It's socially responsible, and it's socially responsible and it impacts change. And it also has the assumption that community involvement or service is a powerful vehicle for leadership. So I guess just from going through those, you can see that it would be a natural fit with this event and working towards growing toward sustainability, that we've thought that this would be a great event, and we're really happy to be able to host it, and we're very happy to have you here today. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. And I think that approaching the process of change towards sustainability as one within that framework is quite exciting, and to do that, we actually have invited some key members of the McGill administration who are able to provide very relevant context, and so I'll be introducing them when we get to the discussion part, and they'll be able to take part in the conversation in a meaningful way. I'd also want to thank the PGSS for helping us hold this event by renting us the space, and for Andrea, our communications intern, who did a ton of work to make this possible, and I hope that you enjoy it.
Great. So I have the pleasure of introducing Gerald Butts, our speaker for today. And could I just see a show of hands? How many are here are students at McGill? How many students do we have? Great. Welcome. How many are undergraduates? Yay, welcome. Okay. And graduate students? So you can look around and see who you are too. And we have some staff here today. Excellent. Thank you so much. So we wanted to include everybody. And the reason why we decided that this would be such a great event, too, is I had an event earlier in January that maybe some of you undergraduate students might have heard about and graduate students, called Leadership for Life. It was a one-day conference on a Saturday. And I was fortunate enough to get Gerald Butts's information and recommendation from our communications area. Daniel McCabe, who works on the McGill Alumni Magazine, was like, yeah, you want somebody good to talk about leadership? Contact Gerald Butts. And I was able to rope him in as our closing address for the conference. It was really great because it was at the closing, being the organizer, as some of you have done, organized events. At the end of it, it's really nice because sometimes you get a chance to sit down and listen. and I was able to sit down and listen with the students that were there. And we all agreed in the evaluations and hearing the students talk to Jerry after. It was just an excellent opportunity, and it was so interesting and insightful. So I was very excited when I was talking to Lilith to go, we should do something else with and have Jerry back. We also just, when I was introducing later, Jerry at the closing address, realized that we both, being a McGill graduates, Gerald Butts has a BA and MA from McGill, we both remembered Leacock 132 being green, overall green. It's much nicer now than it was. Very nice, yes, exactly. He has a lot of achievements that I won't go into too much, because I know, we figured that out before, I don't have to do a huge, huge introduction, but he is currently the CEO and president of World Wildlife Fund Canada. He's a new member on Board of Governors here at McGill, and he was formerly the principal secretary to the Ontario Premier of Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty. And maybe most importantly, he hails from Cape Breton. So it's my pleasure. I'll let Jerry talk, because he'll be that's the crux. And we welcome you here, and welcome very much, Jerry. Thank you very much.
Can you hear me? It's always nice to have expectations set high at the beginning of a speech, Joan. Thanks very much for that. I want to talk to you about a few kind of big picture things today. Can you still? I'm not seeing anybody motion to their ears in the back, so I'm assuming you can hear me. First of all, I want to say it's great to be in Montreal. I think that I grew up in Nova Scotia, went to school in Montreal, now live in Toronto. It's growing on me. It's always great to be here, and I think this institution in particular and this city, I turned into an adult here, or at least some reasonable facsimile thereof. It gives me an incredible feeling to walk around this campus. I do, though, I have to say that when I heard this was in the Thompson ballroom, I didn't know that Thompson House had an upstairs. I thought it was just the pub downstairs, and that's a joke that the graduate students probably get here, and maybe a few lucky undergraduates who've snuck their way in here from time to time. You know, you may expect me to talk about who we are and what we're doing at WWF, and I think many of you have kind of oops, I've got the wrong presentation up here. Oh, keep going. Oh, slick. It's all one. There you go. There's my friend the panda. I'm not really going to go into any great detail. I'm going to assume that many of you have a passing familiarity with what it is we do at WWF. I will tell you that we are an international organization, as I'm sure you know, active in over 100 countries, including Japan, and our hearts and thoughts and prayers go out to colleagues in Japan. I'm sure you've been, like I, almost quasi-addicted to the coverage of the tsunami and the earthquake. And not to begin on a bit of a sad note, but it does make you reflect, you know, in this day and age when we feel we have the world at our fingertips and are able to accomplish electronically just about anything, how awesomely powerful nature is. And regardless of the infrastructure we've built to insulate ourselves from nature's force, that it can come more than knocking on our door at a truly alarming and terrifying rate. And I do want to talk a little bit about how we in Canada have done better, done more to insulate ourselves from nature, even though we have more of it to enjoy, as the beer commercial says. I think it's more square feet of awesomeness than any other country on earth, or whatever they call it. And I think that is true, and I think the fact that we neglect it is to our great peril. So I'm going to get into that as well. But most of all, I want to talk to you about interconnectivity. There's a mouthful. And I also want to talk to you about empathy, because I think that those are the two things that are going to, our recognition of the former and our embracing of the latter are basically what's going to get us out of the pickle we're in from a conservation point of view and from an environmental point of view. I also want to talk to you a little bit about Oreo cookies. I'll show. I'll just breeze through these beautiful pictures of nature and then show you a picture of Oreo cookies. We haven't had lunch yet, so it'll make you all very hungry. It is a big picture I want to talk to you about, cookies and all. And I want you to know that at WWF, this is what we work on. You know, we spend our time around the world organizing ourselves to crack what we think are the big nuts, the big conservation challenges, big environmental challenges facing the planet. And I also want you to come away from my talk thinking that there is hope for the future of the environment. You know, a lot of people have been influenced by, forgive me if you heard me make this joke the last time I was here, but by the kind of Al Gore school of environmentalism, which, while the former vice president did a tremendous job in raising awareness about climate change, you could see it on all the public opinion charts around the world take off like a skyrocket. I think the big mistake in the messaging was this sense of apocalypse. Right, that if we didn't do something about this, then the world was going to end. Well, if you spent any time in places like Mumbai or you've watched people struggle to survive through tragedies like the current one unfolding in Japan, you know our species is quite a bit more resilient than the North American variety of it. While the boomers are not the first generation in the history of the world to confuse their demise with the world's, they have done it in a very kind of poignant way. And in a sense, I think that's created a dead end for the environmental movement, for the conservation movement, because people, all of the problems can be so overwhelming that they're very, you get a sense that who am I to stand up and fight for change? And how can one person make a difference when the problems are so large? And I think we all, including myself, feel that sense of helplessness every once in a while. But one thing to keep in mind when you're overcome by those feelings is a really simple thought, and that is every problem we have, we've been on this planet for tens of thousands of years, and every problem we've had environmentally in the last 300 years, we've created for ourselves. And if we've created these problems for ourselves, it means we can solve them for ourselves. And we spend all of our time at WWF trying to figure out those solutions. And, you know, it's kind of funny. It makes me feel a bit like an old geezer up here talking to you guys. I don't know whether to say I'm older or younger than I look, but I'll tell you the truth. I'm 39. I'll be 40 years old in July. I graduated from McGill with a BA in 1993 and an MA in 1996. And if you want to know how quickly things could change in that short period of time, we in my class, we were privileged to receive the latest technological innovation at the time. I was in the first class at McGill where everybody was given an email address. It was like 9 indecipherable numbers at music A or B, depending on what faculty you're in, .mcgill.ca. And you never really had any idea who was emailing you, and you had these telephone link-ups in your apartment that sometimes worked, sometimes didn't. The whole thing was called Kermit for some reason, and you had a little icon of Kermit the Frog on your Apple IIc or whatever the hell it was we were operating at the time. And that was, I think, 15 years ago. So about five years ago this May, my wife and I had our first child. And we have two. We have a boy and a girl. And my son, who is our eldest, literally his 8th word was BlackBerry. Don't ask me why I counted my son's first words up to 8, but literally his 8th word was BlackBerry, because that was what he saw his dad playing with all the time, or at least he thought I was playing with it. That was when I was in the premier's office. And it got me thinking that, you know, the world can change incredibly quickly. It's hard for probably any of you here to imagine going to university without interconnectivity, without an internet, without the ability to do research online. I don't know if you still stand in line for hours to get reserved reading at McLennan Library like I did. Probably not, right? It's all available to you at the touch of a button. And I say that because no one person directed that change. You know, there wasn't some a puppet master in Washington or London or Hong Kong or Shanghai saying, the world shall be thus, and therefore it became the way it is today. No, the reason the internet grew and blossomed was because billions of people, hundreds of millions of people all over the world, made choices to connect themselves to one another. And I want to argue, and I'll get to this in a moment, that this is one of the most hopeful signs transpiring right now in the world, that you look at BlackBerries today or smartphones today, We had 1 billion people last year participate in Earth Hour. 1 billion people. To our knowledge, it's the only thing 1 billion people on the planet have ever done together. And sure, there are lots of people who say, what does turning your lights off for 60 minutes actually do to save the planet? It's not about that. It's really about demonstrating how connected we can all be at any given moment in time and giving people pause to reflect on what that connectivity means, not just to them, but to their communities, to the communities they belong to their countries, and indeed to the rest of the planet. And, you know, this is kind of the central point I want to make, that whether we want to be or not, and I'll argue in a second that we want to be, we are connected to one another, whether it be the people in this room, the people on this campus, or the people halfway around the world who are suffering right now on the northeast coast of Japan. How many people here have read this book? Well, I'm going to save the rest of you the trouble and give you the synopsis. Maybe you've seen, actually, how many people here watch TED Talks? Ah, there you go. See, there's a difference. There is a huge change between then and now. It would have been the opposite when, what is this internet thing? You'd have a couple of people raise their hand, and everybody else is still beavering away in libraries at books. But the opposite is the case now. That was a really cool TED Talk, by the way, the Jeremy Rifkin thing. It's this amazing video that deploys those weird sped-up drawings to illustrate the points he's making, and I wish I had someone here to draw for me right now, but you'll have to endure my words for a couple of minutes longer. And in any case, in that book and in his talk, Rifkin explains how our brains are actually hardwired for empathy. If you put three babies in a room, and I've tested this at home with two, and one starts crying, the others will too, instinctively. They don't necessarily know why, and neither do we, for that matter. There's just something in our brains that recognizes that others are in the situation we relate to, and we imitate what they're doing when we see it. It's actually a great cognitive mystery for the psychology students in the room. And, you know, what does all... that's not my baby, by the way. I had two pictures of my kids in the last presentation, but I felt like I was being a little... exploitative of my children, as my wife told me. She said, you know, all this stuff ends up online. I said, have you checked our Facebook page lately? But anyway. Rifkin points out that in the last couple of years, by not understanding this empathic relationship we have with each other, we've kind of missed, quote unquote, that's his word, not mine, a few very significant developments until after they happened and how they're connected to one another. The first was in July of 2008 when the price of oil hit $147 a barrel. U.S., and by the way, it's going that way again. And the second was a year later in Copenhagen, a zoo I had the distinct honor of being one of the animals in late 2009, when the entire world gathered and tried to determine what steps to take about climate change, and more or less came up with nothing. What happened? Well, I agree with Rifkin that we missed the interconnectivity of these events. We know the events themselves, the price of oil went up, the world's markets crashed, and we went into recession. The politicians and bureaucrats debated and argued about climate change, not seeing the relationship between any of these things. And I'm sure they will keep talking if we don't achieve anything else. But here's the important point that we missed. As Rifkin says, the world's political and business leaders not only missed the crisis as it started, they didn't really know how to put a recovery plan together because they couldn't operate in the way that their citizens are increasingly operating, and that is between and among one another over large distances of space and time. He says, and these are two interesting quotes. One, they were equally inept at addressing the issue of climate change, despite the fact that the scientific community warns that it poses the greatest threat to our species in its history, and Rifkin's kind of delving into Al Gore territory there. But it's not just figuring out new regulations or greenhouse gas reduction targets. World leaders had some faulty assumptions about human nature. They missed how everything is interconnected. And here's the really interesting part for us today. Biologists and cognitive neuroscientists are just... How many science students are in the room, by the way? Wow, that's a good sign. Biologists and cognitive neuroscientists are discovering mirror neurons, the so-called empathy neurons that allow human beings and other species to feel and experience another's situation as if it were one's own. We are, it appears, the most social of animals in a scientific sense. And it's interesting for someone who studied literature and theology to read this. This is, I'm sure those of you in other disciplines, non-scientific humanities or social sciences disciplines, recognize this principle as a part of almost every area of academic inquiry. I remember studying the English Romantics, and John Keats called this negative capability, the ability to literally put yourself in another person's shoes or in their heart or in their minds, as Keats put it. And by the way, it's good to see science catching up with poetry 200 years later. This has been part of the human endeavor since we crawled out of the caves and built a fire together. And I think one of the main reasons we're in the situation we're in, which I'll describe in a moment at a very high level, is because we've begun to behave as if reality is not reality, that we are indeed individual actors who control our own destiny in a kind of extreme form of individualism that we can lead ourselves to believe for small periods of time, but in the end, the reality of our human condition comes back to bite us in the nether regions. So let's take this a bit further, and I'll tell you what I mean in scientific terms. About every 2 years at WWF, we use scientific metrics to take what we call the pulse of the planet in our Living Planet report. And for those of you who haven't seen this, go to wwf.ca. It's actually a really strong piece of science that we produce every 2 years. There's the cover of it. Basically, what we do is take the world's biocapacity, and I'll explain what these terms mean in a minute, and map it onto our global ecological footprint. And we've been doing this since 1970, before you were born, and actually just before I was born. And we've basically determined that our demand on the planet has more than doubled over the last 40 years, which is an incredible thing to think about. In that short period of time. And in short, we're using more than the world is producing. So if we were to consume every year the way we consume now, we would need a planet and a half to sustain our consumption. And what does that mean in concrete terms? We measure the ability of the Earth's biomes to reproduce the renewable resources we use on an annual basis. And the reason people say, well, how can you use a planet and a half? It's really simple. In economic terms, we're eating into the equity that the planet has built up for us over 5.5 to 6 billion years. And in the same period, the health of those ecosystems, not surprisingly, has declined almost 30%. You put those two findings together, and that's our ecological footprint. About half of this footprint comes from carbon emissions, from transportation, heating, and electricity, from fossil fuels. Canada is, by the way, I'm not sure why I need to show you the number 7. I think you all know what it looks like. Canada is number 7, the 7th worst per capita for carbon emissions among 130 countries we measure. This is more than twice the average global citizen's consumption rate, and if everyone on Earth lived as Canadians do, we would need about 4 Earths just to produce what we consume on an annual basis. Now, when I speak to business audiences, I often talk about future generations dealing with this. Not here. Your generation and mine, if I can be allowed to stretch it a little bit, will be out there making decisions and running things a lot sooner than you think. So let me put this to you. Given our resource use relative to the rest of the world, as Canadians, do you think we have a moral and ethical imperative to tackle our own footprint without waiting for others to act, as some political leadership would suggest we need to do? We're 50, by the way. We actually know how to do this, and WWF Canada and WWF globally has been working on these problems for 50 years. It's our 50th anniversary this year, and we've been working on these questions for a very long time. We've got a very ambitious program to shift our energy mix in Canada and around the world to renewable sources. We believe these solutions are crucial to fighting climate change, and we believe they can create new business opportunities and the green jobs that many of you in this room will make your living doing for the rest of your lives. And here is where you come in, and I bring back the Oreos. In Canada, I think that one of our main problems is that we need a mature debate on the health of our planet. It's gotten way too politicized over the past 5 years. Conservation used to be a nonpartisan issue. It is no longer. We need a really robust discussion, and shortly, of our options. And we do have options. conservation should be nonpartisan. Our fresh water, energy efficiency, reducing waste, none of these has an obvious political, an obvious party affiliation. And that's not to say there isn't room for debate. Of course there's room for debate. But that debate should be about how we get these things done, not whether or not they need doing in the first place. What can you do in all this? It's not that simple, but I think it's rooted in reconnecting with nature. Like I said at the outset, Canada has more natural beauty than any country in the world. I'll show you a bit of it. Canadians, yet here, and this is the paradox of Canadian life, we are the world's most urban people. More than 80% of Canadians live in cities. That's a higher rate of urbanization than any country in the world. And with more and more Canadians living in cities every day, it becomes easier and easier to forget the natural systems on which we depend for literally everything. You know, I often have a saying that everything, if you dig deep enough, is 100% natural. Everything comes from and ultimately returns to the natural world, and I'm not just talking about food here. Let me give you a couple of really interesting examples. How many science students in the room, so you would have heard of this, how many people have heard of tantalum? One industrious internet researcher there. Tantalum is a key ingredient in every electronic gadget. Your smartphone, the BlackBerry my son was talking about, and the one you're probably checking during my speech here. But it's also mined in one of the deadliest and most threatened places on the face of the earth. That is the Democratic Republic of Congo. Congo contributes less than 1% of the world's tantalum. In some of the world's most important and threatened tropical forests. That's where the world has endured one of the most tragic wars, with almost 7 million people dead in the last 15 years, and terrible environmental degradation in one of the most treasured ecosystems on the planet. Much of this is over who controls tantalum. So a small piece of a big supply chain creates that kind of havoc. I'll give you a little an example that's a little more hopeful. For an art student, this is a mouthful. Tollypocladium inflatum. How many people have heard of that? Well, I hope you never need to. It's a fungus discovered in the soil of a relatively nondescript plateau in Norway. Turns out that this microorganism is the active ingredient in cyclosporine, the wonder drug that prevents organ rejection in complex transplant cases. Who knew? So there you go. One thing, tantalum, you use every day or minute. And another I hope you never need. Both direct from planet Earth, and we live with the consequences of how we gather and how we use these resources. And not just locally, we live with the consequences of how other members of our species do this halfway around the world. Everything in sum is connected. Many of us Canadians are, we don't realize this because many of us Canadians are effectively raised in captivity. We experience nature only through the media or online. How many people here have ever slept, not to turn this into a Q&A session, but how many people here have ever slept in a tent? You truly are an advanced class. Okay, trick question though. How many people have ever slept in a tent more than 500 meters from a car? Slightly smaller group of people. But most of our kids these days, and I see it with my own children, experience nature only through the media or online. Some of the research that we have conducted at WWF shows an alarming number of people, and especially young people, with a lack of interest in and concern for nature. How do we change this? Well, you know, it's really up to you. It's going to take a real strong imagination, the same sense of imagination that created the world we have today, in order to solve the problems we've made for ourselves. This sense of interconnectedness, imagination, and empathy is going to be more and more important for you. We hear a lot about this in the context of telecommunications and business, but just as important, and maybe even more important, it's more important to conservation and sustainability. How so? Finally, I'm going to get back to the Oreos. Keep your taste buds going for the Oreos. My kids love Oreos. You probably love Oreos. And when you crack open that box, look at the ingredients. Almost every, I'm not just picking on Oreos, almost every cookie you'll find in a Loblaws or a Provigo has palm oil in it. Anybody know where palm oil is from or what it does? There we go. Palm oil is from oil palms, which are grown largely in the great equatorial rainforests. And in one of the most precious and pristine of those rainforests, in the island of Borneo, it's also home to these guys. Now, these guys are just probably the cutest members of that forest. The truth is, the next tantalum, the next whatever that word was I said 5 minutes ago, may be found in these forests. And I think at the heart of the conservation movement is to be able to imagine yourself in a position where you cannot account for all the possibilities you're losing by destroying places like Borneo. And when you think about the things that we're destroying these places to do, it's not something we're going to want to answer for 200, 300, 400 years from now, or even answer to our own children and grandchildren. You know, a friend of mine, a more cynical friend than I, once said to me that we're burning down the house so we have a fire to roast marshmallows. And I don't think that we're quite at that point yet. But the only way to turn away from that point, because we're certainly on that continuum, is to choose to do things with your life that don't become part of that process. Or at best, at its very best, you help move big organizations, either from the inside or outside, away from the path of development they're on currently toward a more sustainable one. And in the end, this really isn't about the orangutans. It's about us, right? I mean, people ask me all the time what I've learned by working at WWF over the last almost 3 years. And the one thing I've learned, one thing that's been impressed on me more than anything else, is that we are a species like other species. You know, we huddle together for warmth. We go where resources are plenty. And we try to stay away from things that will kill us. That basically is the three-part recipe for any species success. Where we're different from everybody else is that we've figured out how, on a massive landscape-altering global scale, to take the things we need from where we find them and to put them where we'd like to have them. And that sounds like a really simple, straightforward thing, but that, in a nutshell, is what has caused deforestation in the Amazon, in Borneo. It's what's caused environmental degradation all over the world. And why have we been able to do that? In the end, we've been able to do it because we've imagined ourselves out of the chain that sustains us as a species. We've come to believe over the past 200 years, or we've tried to convince ourselves over the last 200 years, that we are actually different. You know, that we can take resources inexhaustibly from the planet. Through our own ingenuity, we can replenish those resources and ourselves. And I'll tell you something, the definition of a non-renewable natural resource is that it's non-renewable. And you guys, more than me and my kids, are the ones who are going to live the consequences of that. So time is short, you have robust imaginations, you're getting an excellent education, and you're going to need it. So thank you very much for your attention. I'm happy to take questions, by the way.
Yeah.
If there are any. Is there anybody still awake? Yeah. Do you need to stretch?
If, as you say, one of the big challenges, if not the biggest challenge, is just sensitizing our highly urban youth to nature, is the World Wildlife Fund doing anything to encourage exposure to the natural environment in our educational system?
Yeah, we are. We're not doing enough, though, and that's actually one of my big priorities. I think that There's a great book that I read. I kind of consumed all these books on parenting because I was so scared when my wife was pregnant the first time, called Last Child in the Woods. I don't know if anybody's heard of that book. And it's a really interesting study by an American. It's not a peer-reviewed science study, but he connects a lot of the socialization problems children are having with a cutoff from nature. And he's created this movement in the United States called childrenandnature.org, which is an umbrella funding architecture for local groups that do everything from teach kids what the trees are in their backyard to pay for summer camp and that sort of thing. And I think that's a critical missing piece in Canada's education system. We work with curriculum development programs in Ontario, Alberta, and British Columbia. Alberta's a really interesting case on that front. But we're not doing nearly enough. And I think that ultimately you can't replace nature ethic in the way you raise your children. And it's so overwhelming for a lot of parents. They think they have to take their kid to Banff, right? You don't really. The truth is, and one of my favorite stats, I can't remember the exact numbers, but your average six-year-old knows something like 1,200 brands and three trees. You know, it's we think of these things as relatively mundane, but they're critically important. You know, learn what the birds are in your backyard and take your kid out to tell him or her about it. Who knows what kind of lifelong fascination or attachment you're fostering in those moments, right?
I just wanted to comment that because I've been poisoned by environmental toxins, I only understood about 52% of what you said today. That's a note. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that concerns me, the most important thing I picked up was that we're hardwired for empathy. Well, what happened to all the politicians and all the CEOs of all the corporations? Where is their empathy? I've seen more empathy in a baby raccoon.
Yeah, I think that we've got a really complex task ahead of us. I think that you know, we've created a system for ourselves, an economic system, that depends on us not knowing the consequences of our purchases. You know, you hear this all the time. And I remember when I was in my previous line of work, we were doing a trade mission to China. And we were under lots of pressure to put pressure on the government in China on human rights issues. And their human rights record is abhorrent. I think we would all agree with that. But what bothered me most about, and this was around the same time that people were protesting the Beijing Olympics, and what bothered me most about it was this sense that everything that's transpiring in Asia is something that's happening over there and not connected to us, right? The reason the Chinese economic system operates the way it operates is so I can have a choice of 25 different $10 t-shirts for my kids. And it's not because that demand is satiated in Asia. This has been done for our benefit. And when I say our benefit, I mean a really small group of we, right? And I think it's really easy, and I hope you don't take offense at this, man, but I think it's really easy to look at political leadership or business leadership and say, if only those people in those positions of leadership would take a different view of things, then things would change overnight. No politician or business leader created the internet, right? And I think that we diminish ourselves as human agents when we feel powerless in the face of big problems. And I really think that I've met a lot of good people in business, good leaders of big corporations who want to do the right thing, and a lot of them who are doing the right thing. But they need that positively reinforced by the market. And this, I think, is the rub, right? We believe in market-based solutions to environmental problems at WWF. And I think we've had some really strong successes on that front. But until the market has the right signals, it's going to fail every time, whether it be on carbon pricing or the cost of water or you name it. We are not going to have a solution to these problems unless the broad base of the general population gets the right signals. So, sir?
Education.
It's part of it. It's part of it.
Hello, my name is Manuel. I have a master in sustainability, and I applied for a job 3 years ago. I was living across the street in from World Wide Foundation offices. Ah, the fact that it's also a comment because I've been actually thinking if I should do a PhD in sustainability. I think I might be too old to go back to school for so long.
Never too old.
But something that I keep on studying, and I'm some of the things that I've been thinking lately is that I read a book for Living Simply with Children about Mary Sher's book that you can find on Queen Street in Toronto if you're interested, mm-hmm. to grow your kids in a sustainable way. The fact that we live in Canada is we live in a country that cannot sustain human life per se. It's a country where we live off technology. We need technology to be alive. And we always, I don't know how many of the people here went to Quebec to protest the Economic Forum demonstration, right. or how many people here will protest the Beijing Olympics, but we are here at noon in a beautiful sunny day. We have 6 curtains closed and we have 25 lights turned on. The fact that we're living like this is sending these signals to consumers that we don't care about our planet, mm-hmm. And that we are ourselves, even in a such beautiful day like this, closing ourselves to nature and trying to live in this bubble that cannot sustain us.
I don't necessarily disagree with anything you said. I mean, I think that to a lesser or greater extent, at least the Europeans who've inhabited Canada for the last 500 years or so have always depended on technology, right? We've just become a lot more adept at inventing and adapting that technology to our social circumstances. But I don't agree, actually, that it's the way we live that is, not the way we live, but it's not modernism. This is not a problem with modernism. This is not a problem with modern economies. I think that the great part and the horrific part about modern economies is that they're amoral. And the market will respond to whatever signals are given to it, especially when it comes to prices. It's way too soon for us to give up on free market economics. We've never even really tried at a large scale. Look at the debate we just came through on carbon pricing, you know, and think about that. You know, this is kind of the final point. I'll stop picking on Al Gore, this is kind of the final point. My fear isn't that there aren't going to be human beings walking around 200, 300 years from now. It's that there will be, right? And they're going to look at us and say, what was up with you guys? You had all the information you needed. You had all the technology you needed. And why didn't you do it? Because it was a little too expensive and inconvenient.
I was not saying that about the free...
That's okay.
I was not talking about that. We don't... That technology is bad per se, or free markets. I'm a firm believer of free markets. And that's why I think when we start opening the windows and turning the lights on, so we're going to be
right.
sending these
Fair
markets
enough.
the signal that we care about our environment and we're actually reducing our footprint.
Great. Shoot. What's your name?
Jonathan.
What are you studying?
Pardon me?
What are you studying?
I'm studying environment, actually, in philosophy. Yeah. I'd like to kind of shift the discussion a little bit towards... We all have those case studies, those examples in our head, and you mentioned organizational change as one means for hope or whatever. We all have those narratives, those things that we can point to as like a demonstration for something concrete in our current lifetime that has actually affected change and that motivates you maybe. If you could offer one of yours, I'd like something on the bigger scale. And internet's cool, but
yeah.
maybe something more to you've seen an organization shift or a discussion
sure.
shift.
Yeah,
like that.
I'll give you a couple of them. Let me start with the one that we've been directly involved in. And it's not uncontroversial, but we have a trans-global relationship with Coca-Cola. And Coke has reduced, because of that partnership, they've reduced their water footprint by 30% over the last 15 years. Now, you know, you can question, lots of people say, well, why are you working with a company like Coke, and what kind of social value does Coke actually have if you're traveling in a place with no clean drinking water? You'd see the social value in it, but... there were lots of people when we started that said, these guys will never change. They just want to greenwash and use the panda as a convenient marketing strategy. But let me tell you, man, they are a deadly serious company when it comes down to setting targets and meeting them. They were one of the first people in our climate first organizations in our Climate Saver program, and they reduced their own source emissions by 15%. You know, they actually proved on a global scale that carbon-free growth is a possibility. And I think that is an enormous benefit. And there are other companies in the Climate Savers Program, including Johnson & Johnson, and some unlikely candidates like Lafarge, who've also done the same. So I think when you get everybody aligned around a cohesive strategy to reduce emissions and your footprint, it can happen. But, you know, I think even more than that, even more important than that, those one or two examples, as big as they may be, and just to put Coke in some context for you, you know, people, I made this statement that people maybe took out of context about a year ago, and when I said that I was frustrated after being in Copenhagen for a week and a half during the UNFCCC climate talks, and I said that Coke is actually a more effective. Someone was criticizing a relationship with Coke, and I said, Coke is more important to the environment than the United Nations is right now. And the reason I said that is because Coke is the number one purchaser of aluminum in the world. They purchase 3% of the world's sugar, and it goes on and on. Second biggest purchaser of citrus. And if they choose to say that we will only purchase commodities that are grown in a certain way, third-party certified sustainable way, then it changes the global supply chain overnight, right? So part of what we do at WWF, a big part of what we do on our business engagement strategy, is to understand which companies have the most leverage in the biggest supply chains on the most impactful commodities. So we literally have a strategy that's run out of if you look up Jason Clay, his last name, C-L-A-Y, and watch his TED Talk, it's really amazing the strategy that he's developed out of the U.S., which is to look at the 15 commodities that have the deepest footprint on the planet, analyze the companies that are integral to the supply chain of those commodities, and constructively engage with the top 10. As it turns out, the top 10 control about 80% of those commodities. They're conveniently located. It's like a suburban shopping mall. Work with them to change the way they manage their supply chains. You can change the world in a very short period of time. Sir.
Oh, hi. Just to follow up on that, there's a sort of classic problem as you increase the efficiency of a product, you actually can increase the total level of consumption.
Yeah.
And so that's a really good example. Okay, we can work with these corporations. We can improve their products and make them
green.
Just
to be clear, though, this is not an efficiency gain, right? This
right, is, but we can improve, you know, we can have a green Coke or something.
Right.
Maybe it'll be more expensive. It's more desirable. Consumption can possibly go up in total. And then the classic problem is with automobiles. Increase the efficiency of cars, and it's more available. It eventually becomes more available to more people, but then you have a greater net impact because there's more people using the product. So how do you manage that or reconcile that?
But risk. First of all, I'd question a couple of those assumptions. One is that it depends on a lot of variables, right? And if you're increasing the consumption by 10% and decreasing the impact by 50, then overall you have a net gain. And those are the kinds of things we're after. When I say that you can grow business, you can grow the business, but not the carbon. What I mean is that not the efficiency of the carbon emitted per unit produced, but the overall emissions profile of the company. And that, to me, is the most important thing, right? And that was kind of the crux of the issue in Canada about oil sands, that the oil sands companies were all saying, look, we're much more, we have a lower footprint than we did 10 years ago, and we're making improvements all the time. But overall, the emissions growth was dwarfing any efficiency gain. That doesn't have to be the case depending on the supply chain. If Coke decides it's only going to purchase sustainably grown sugar, it will actually have a net positive impact on agriculture all over the world. because their weight in the supply chain dictates that if you want to sell to them, if you want to sell profitably, you're going to sell to them, and if you want to sell to them, you're going to have to grow in a certain way. So.
Hi, my name is Oscar Guerrero. I'm an engineer, an entrepreneur. I would like to ask people here, how many engineers do we have in the room? Three. How many business people? Business students or business people in general? Okay. So that's one and three engineers. I think personally that sustainability is a very intricate topic that is tightly linked with engineering and business management. Mm-hmm. And one, let me give you one example that I found a couple of years ago that was very hilarious in my opinion. NASA made a contest for students to design their next space station. And the winner was a Chinese student that created something beautiful, yes, but it had absolutely no green zones in it. So if the next space station is meant to search for our next home in the universe, why doesn't it have even a single green space in it, right? So this is why I want to bring this up and why it's tightly linked with businesses and entrepreneurs. Right now, the biggest development in sustainability comes from entrepreneurs, innovation in many, many companies around the world. Someone, the student here asked about an example of a company that dwells in sustainability. I found that GE dwells a lot in sustainability. Yeah. They have the biggest impact on wind power. They're working with China not to make them better or anything, but just to decrease the carbon footprint in China at the same time. So I think this kind of talks right now that you're a very interesting person. I'd love to talk. I would love to talk more.
But I'm not useful.
But even then, no. Just contact-wise, for instance, any engineer, any business student would gain a world simply by knowing you. But they're not here, unfortunately.
Well, it's interesting you say that, though, because on our business engagement team, there are five people, and four of them are MBAs, and one's an engineer.
Again, my point.
So.
All right, that's just a point I wanted to bring up.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There's someone else.
Hi, my name is Ben. I study physics.
If I'm squinting, it's because of the glare from the windows in the back. I can just see your outline.
My question is about, you say that you're pro-market solution. And I know that wouldn't be in a naive sense. It would be you want some changes to the market to address the shortcomings, the market failures that have partially led to our problems. Yeah. And I was just wondering what some of those solutions would be.
Well, I think appropriate pricing for non-renewable commodities is the most important, right, without a question. And amongst those commodities, carbon and carbon emissions and or the commodities that are the source of carbon emissions, like fossil fuels principally, water are probably at the top, but it all kind of gets enveloped in what we call putting an appropriate price on nature, right? It's a very difficult thing to do. The econometric modeling is not very well developed. The whole discipline, which really began in earnest with natural capitalism in the mid-80s, is not well developed. You know, more people need to do PhDs on this subject and go work for companies. It's kind of the point you were making, that it's up to you guys to figure this one out. You know, this is what you should be studying.
Okay, I had sort of a corollary question.
Sure.
So the WWF doesn't propose any systematic changes, for instance, to the corporate charter.
I wouldn't quite go that far. I mean, we think that sustainability should be a business principle and not just at a high kind of theological level, but it should be part of work plans and business plans for every organization that has an impact on the environment, which is just about every private firm. From a political or legislative or regulatory perspective, we're pushing and fighting all over the world for transparency in supply chains, right? That is a huge piece of this puzzle. You know, if people knew, and not just the people who buy Oreo cookies, which is why I keep making this this point, but the people at Nestle. You know, I guarantee you, before Greenpeace ran their very provocative campaign about Nestle and orangutans 3 years ago, there wasn't a person outside the purchasing department or the procurement department at Nestle that knew where oil palms came from, right? For them, it was just a list of one in a list of 35 ingredients on their cookies. But when you realize that, that was a Kit Kat bar, actually, not an Oreo cookie, but when you realize what kind of impact those purchases have, then I think, then it's really up to you, right? You know, because it's easy for us to say, well, I had no idea where that came from or what was done to produce that or what that country was like. But when you have that information, then you're in a real a position of moral authority to make a decision.
Thanks.
One more? Sure.
It's not a question. It's a statement, observation. On behalf of the few 50-plus people who are here today, I want to tell the younger people that when you said it's up to you to study about this and fix it, I don't think that's true. I think we're all in it. I think that the older generation is concerned too. My generation was the Silent Spring generation.
Right, of course,
we grew up
yeah.
with that. We're very concerned. So I don't want you to feel you're alone. We're all worried about it.
That's a good note to end on.
Thanks a lot. So thank you very much, Sherry. It was a pleasure. I'd encourage you all to look up the Jeremy Rifkin RSA TED Talk. It's really fascinating. And on that note of a call to action, we're now going to go into the open space discussion. We'll get into exactly what that is in a second. But there are a couple things I want you to keep in mind when we do break out to actually talk about projects that within McGill's context can happen right now. So there are two resources I want to highlight briefly that as you're conceptualizing these projects or the actions that you personally and collectively can take to move McGill towards sustainability. The first is applied student research. I think for those of you who are students, there are a lot of opportunities to look at McGill as a living laboratory through your coursework. Some of these courses these are sort of examples. You can also design your own independent study, and I'm sure that there are others that aren't on this list, but in every discipline there are usually project opportunities. The second is the Sustainability Projects Fund has $800,000 a year for student and staff-led projects that build a culture of sustainability at McGill, and it's for exactly these kinds of initiatives to be able to unleash the potential that is you guys by providing the resources. Here are some examples that have come out of groups of people coming together around an idea and committed to making it happen. Feel free to get in touch with me if you have any further questions. And I'm going to hand it to Joan to talk a bit more about the open space discussion that we're about to launch into.
So, oh, and there'll also be a break for lunch, since we've been looking at Oreo cookies for a little while. So basically we have the other part that Lilith and I were so excited about was just that whoever is here, and this is one of the real principles of open space, it's referred to as open space technology. Has anyone here done open space technology? A few? Yeah? Good? Okay. One of the principles of open space technology is that the people that are here are, you're an incredible resource. The right people are here. We're going to be able to like have discussions around that and discuss different topics that are pertinent to you. So, and there's also an opportunity to, we have great resources in the room with all of you basically. So, What we're going to do is collect some topics. We have some topics that might be interesting to center discussions on. But basically, open space is an approach to meetings or events or conferences that's focused on a specific and important task or purpose. But, surprise, it begins without an agenda. So it's up to you. It's a really interesting way of having a free discussion, meaningful discussion. So we hope that that you came prepared and have been kind of like thinking about different topics that might be interesting for you that you'd like to discuss. The rules of the open space discussion, what we thought we'd do is collect some topics, see if people had specific subjects that they wanted to talk about. We'll get it organized in this room probably and arrange like little circles of chairs for people to go to talk about the different whatever topics they want to talk about. For instance, if people want to talk about energy at McGill, we might have a group right here, and all the people that sit down at this circle are going to talk about energy. The rules, the law of 2 feet, just means that if you're in a circle, you're there to engage in the discussion. Whether it's listening or speaking, it's just to take part in it. Also, you can... There's the principle of you can be a bee or you can be a butterfly. So you can be a bee and stay with one discussion and engage in that, or you might be a person that wants to go around to the different discussions and hear the different discussions that are going on. So it's a very free way, and we did this in November with an open space discussion on leadership, just to like... get people talking. It's also a really interesting opportunity to network and find out common interests and partnerships. So
the resources that I mentioned to you before who are here, we have Jerome, who is Conroe, who is the energy manager for McGill, Gary Bernstein, who's the director of network and communication services, Laura Rhodes, who's the food system administrator in food and dining. I also see Barbara Wimmett from University Services and Kathleen Ng, the environmental officer for McGill. So there are people who can very wisely inform the discussions. So the step that we're going to take now, this all probably seems a little fuzzy. We're going to ask you with those sticky notes to write down a topic that you would be interested to lead a discussion on. It can be a project idea, or an area within McGill that you feel is really important to take action, and bring the sticky notes up to the front. Then you're going to go get lunch, and we'll organize the sticky notes into sort of the themes that emerge and send you around the different areas. We'll have a map of where the discussions will be taking place. So if you can take a few minutes to think about this and write the topics that you want to be talking about, whether it's a project idea or more of a theme, on those sticky notes, and just bring them up and put them on this screen. And then break for lunch, and we'll organize it into the discussion groups and come back together and break into those groups.
Yeah. We'll have about 15-20 minutes to let everybody discuss the topics, and then we'll call a break and see if you want to move on to a second topic. So we'll have two discussions.
Thank you. Oh, yeah. Any questions? Okay.
You guys are very...
Great. Okay. So bring up your ideas.
And grab some lunch.